This evening, our plan is the following. We're in the fourth section of David's children. Our focus this evening is going to be looking at Perek Yud Dalet in Shmuel Beis, and our focus is going to be trying to look at the Isha Tekoit, the woman from Tekoa. We're trying to appreciate the message she gave. Now, we did a little bit of this last time, but I think it's important just to recap a little bit, just to understand what's really going on over here. It's clear that David HaMelech is at odds with Avshalom. Avshalom has murdered his firstborn Amnon, so David HaMelech harbors a lot of pain. We saw there was a little bit of a debate as to whether there's an opportunity here where he feels like he's closer to Avshalom or whether he's still harboring this pain and guilt inside. Either way, what happens is that Yoav goes to action. And he goes and he hires this lady from Tekoa. Tekoa is a place where people were more wise in general, Isha Chachama. And so he sends her in. So let's quickly listen to her. Let's learn together to her actual words, her imagery that she uses, and try with at the back of our minds, keeping in our mind, Mashal and Nimshal. Let's understand what the metaphor is and what she's trying to say, because not all of it adds up. Not all of it adds up necessarily. So let's try to unpack that a little bit. We're going to look at, if we're in the Psukim itself, we're in Shmuel Beis, Perek Yud Dalet, and we're going from Psukim Dalet to Yud Beis, just to get a sense of her whole speech, the whole cadence of it, rather than seeing it in pieces. So here's what we have. So she says to him, she falls on her face, she prostrates herself. Please save me, O King. What's going on? He says to her. I am a widow and my husband passed away. You'll notice, by the way, the fact that she interjects, we saw aval, means to say she's already in a defensive position. The king is already seemingly wondering why she's there or why she's acting in the way she does. So aval is already a defensive stance which she's taking. Also, you notice the double expression she's using over here. She seems to be describing the same thing twice, right? She's an almana and a meisisha, which sounds like, by the way, what sounds like is that there's a double masculine figure missing in her life, which is exactly what she's about to say. Husband and son, right? So just in terms of like sort of we're seeing the shadow already. So they were fighting, her two children, her two sons were fighting in the field. One gets up and kills the other one. And the rest of the family is demanding justice. What they're going to do, they want to take out the murderer, kill him now, and destroy the Yoresh, the inheritor. And therefore my husband is no longer going to have a name or a continuation on this land. By the way, which mishpacha do you think this is? Where is the family? Which extension? Masmin? Which family could be making this claim? Let's just to try to put this in context. Must be. It's probably what's happening over here is his family. What it sounds like is his family wants to sort of stop this line of the family, right? So the husband's gone, which is the brother, son, whatever it was, and then he had two children. One's gone. They're trying to remove the last because they talk about Yerusha. They talk about inheritance. So they're really essentially cutting off this line of the family over here. So it's her in-laws who are speaking, and it sounds like over here, who are trying to eradicate this. Now, Vayomer HaMelech Elisha, so the king responds, terrible, this is a terrible story. What he says, Lechili Veseich V'ani Atzaveh Alayich. He says, you go home, I'll reach out to you, I'll tell you. You have to work out what the dialogue is in a second. Vatomer Elisha Atako Yisrael HaMelech, I will take responsibility for the sin. You are acquitted. Which means to say, essentially, she's pushing back. This is a very strong lady. She's speaking to the king of Israel. He is a very powerful person. The fact that she's pushing back, why is she pushing back? We have to think to ourselves, what is the dialogue? What was he saying that was not enough for her? She's pushing back to the king. And in fact, he responds, Vayomer HaMelech, HaMedaber Alayich, you are speaking to me, nobody's going to touch you anymore. Hashem should remember you, what you just said. That's obviously clearly to her is a dramatic irony. She's referencing Hashem should remember what you said because she's about to use it against him. Right? And my son should not be hurt. And he takes an oath by the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that no hair will be touched on her remaining son's body. And she says, now I want to just ask you one more thing, and she's about to speak. So before she gets into her, and she launches into her attack, we didn't spend too much time focusing on over here. It's just the basics of her case. In her case, she's clearly trying to defend whom?
Her son.
The remaining son is the one she's defending. What grounds does she give for his defense? What grounds are there for his defense? What grounds are there for his guilt? Let's try to put those together. Before we get to the Nimshal, let's try to understand. What, based on what grounds should he be acquitted of the murder? That's not a good reason. That ends just don't justify means here, right? So you know what you're saying. It's like let the murderer get out. He might have a nice family. I know that's not. She's saying more. You see what's a dangerous argument? Because otherwise you'll say everybody has a future, right? But the point is no. There's more than that. Yes, Jelly. Okay, good. So let's look at the way she describes this. Let's look at this for a second. She says they're in the field. They're fighting. No one else is there. And they kill. So the Malbim identifies in that description, not necessarily the ends, just the actual means itself. Malbim identifies three reasons as to why maybe there might be reasons for grounds for acquittal. Let's take a quick look at this Malbim. The Malbim is in the first source on source 34 on page 8. The Malbim says the following. I just put it into bullet form here. He says Vayinatzu Hodia Gimel Ta'anot She'en V'No Chayav Mita. Three reasons why her son should not be responsible. Number one, to be culpable in Beis Din, there's a legal process. You need to have witnesses and you need to have warning. She specifically labels the case as something which is beyond the purview of justice. Because why? There were no legal witnesses, number one. Number two, v'ein matzil b'nehem, v'oifen she'ilu hoya matzil, lo higia lidei kach, ki hoya korov l'shogeg. Okay, so going back to you, Shelley. Meaning to say, if there were to have been somebody there, maybe somebody could have interceded. There was nobody there, so maybe it went too far and it's a shogeg. Now, that's a very interesting psychological claim, because then you could say this in any murder, right? It got out of hand, right? He didn't mean to pull out his gun in the bar, right? But in the end of the day, he did. But the point is that there was nobody to intercede. Now, this might be actually more for the Nimshal in a second. That's a remarkable claim. You'd think this, by the way, this is 21st century law. When you think about this, we need to understand him. We need to understand what was going on over there. That's number two. Number three, they each hit each other. What does that mean? It says, Masha Kefel Hakinui. That which it doubles out. So we need that both hitting each other. They're fighting on one another. Ima Poel More, Shapiro Shoi, Kiilo Apal Kaful. Vayaku, Vayach. They each hit each other. One of them killed. The fellow who you're saying is that perpetrator might be the victim in self-defense. And that also brings us back to number one. There wasn't anybody there, so we don't know. You know, when you deal with victimhood and the victimizer, it's not always easy to see who the victim and the victimizer is. You know, like, take for example, read the Palestinian conflict. You know, the Palestinians are perpetually considered the victim. Now, in some cases they are, but in many cases they're not. Right? I mean to say, it is not Israel's air raids which are deliberately going and destroying places in Gaza. It is not Israel who are going out to kill innocent civilians on the Gaza border. They are responding. Israel is responding to a certain situation. But if you take one snapshot, you take one frame, then you get the wrong end of the picture. Right? We have to work out who's the perpetrator, who's the victim. So what she's saying is, it was a fight. It could have been self-defense. Right? Where do you snap that picture? Those are the three things she says. Now, let's try to turn that around now. So with those three ideas, how does she, obviously she's driving this into him, right? This is so sharp. How is she driving this back at David HaMelech? How are these three applications to David? Because remember, there's obviously two sons in his life. There's an Amnon and there's Avshalom. One kills the other. Can she flip these around into him? Some stronger, some less strong. Let's take a look at how the Malbim does it. Skipping down to the bottom of the Malbim over here, in the next paragraph. At the very bottom, he says, V'gimol ha'dvarim ha'ele, heim gam v'nimshal. They are the application. Number one is, you don't have legal recourse because it was a private murder. Now, just to clarify something, you know, generally speaking, Beis Din can't kill without Edim and Hasra. They can't kill without legal witnesses and warning. The king can, by the way. The king has that ability to do without, he's able to use circumstantial evidence. But in a court of law, they have to have a certain process, and they're lacking that process. So she's saying on the legal side of it, there may not be the grounds. That's number one. Number two, listen to this. This to me is the most powerful one. What does it mean there was no there was no one to be in the field to help the brothers? How does that flip around to the David case? She accuses him. Who's the interceder? The one should have been you, David HaMelech. Why? Because if you'd taken justice against Amnon after the terrible rape of Tamar, then maybe then we would never got to the situation where Avshalom felt he needed to take the law into his own hands. That's the Ein Matzil B'Yadam in the field. Wow, that's a very shocking claim. That's a very, very shocking claim. That's the flip around. I think that's the strongest, the most biting claim she has. And the third one is very fascinating. And number three is the following. V'shagam Amnon hika oso bameh she'inoi u'biyesh yisachosoi v'korov lozeh kosav amari. So he says, let's think about it. Let's talk about where we snap that picture. Where we look at the victim, where we look at the perpetrator. Yes, on the one hand, Avshalom was the victimizer by killing Amnon. But who was the original victimizer? Was Amnon himself for raping Tamar. Now, two wrongs don't necessarily make a right. But at the same time, what he's saying is, David HaMelech, you're looking at this in a very small spectrum. You didn't do anything in the first episode when there was a first victimizing victim. But now you are doing something or you want to do something in the second case. That doesn't square. So do you see what's happening over here? It says the Malbim is that this is directly attacking David HaMelech on three levels as to why he can harbor hate or discord with his son Avshalom. Very, very powerful way of looking at it. Just one pasuk in terms of unpacking it. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to have to work that out. We're going to have to try to unpack that because as Avshalom grows more powerful and Avshalom himself feels that same feeling you're expressing now, we're going to see that. So I want to get to that at the Nebezer Hashem next time because when we see Avshalom starting to draw, he becomes a magnet for power against his father. At that moment in time, as he starts doing that, we have to work out what's he missing. Why is it that he felt that David HaMelech wasn't relating to him? And the very, very end of today, God willing, we'll see one part which contributes to that as well. So that's a very, very good point, and I think Avshalom is sensing exactly what you're saying. And that's exactly the lack of justice he feels. Let's take it one step further. This is at least the Malbim as well. What I was wondering over here is like this whole business with the Redeemer of the Blood, right? So she basically says that the family, so in this case, in the Mepharshim, a lot of the Mepharshim assume it's the in-laws, right? Right, and this is not to generalize about all in-laws, right? Right, there's some wonderful in-laws out there, but in this case, the in-laws want to kill her other son to take revenge. So she is saying, essentially, this is an interesting legal question over here. Legally speaking, if there is a murder which has taken place in the land of Israel, and certainly the time when it's governed by the law as given by biblical Torah, what would happen if a murder happened? Let's say it was a murder by mistake. It was not intentional. What's the halacha? So generally speaking, it's so interesting. In all cases of murder, whether it be unintentional, whether it be completely unknowingly, that's not a mistake. What's called misasek. The person didn't even realize they were doing it, as opposed to they knew the action they were doing, but the action had great ramifications, or it was intentional. Right? All three cases, any murderer would always go to Ir Miklat. Any murderer. Then what would happen is that for the legal due process, they would be taken out into court, and they would be tried. If they were seen to be, if they were found to be an intentional murderer, then what would happen? Beistin would kill him, but not Beistin specifically. The Torah explicitly says, Goel Adam, the closest relative of the deceased, will be the one who flicks the switch on the electric chair, or whatever it is. In those days, we had the Arba Mrs. Beistin. They would be the one, Goel Adam, Yaladim Teyabo Birushana, is by the witnesses, but the Goel Adam would be part of that process. Right? So the Goel Adam, in a certain sense, there is a linkage in the, so to speak, retribution, or in terms of the blood being settled, so to speak, in that case. That's in terms of the legal process. Let's say the person, it was not sound evidence. It was clearly a mistake. Then the person's returned to the Ir Miklat. Why is they returned to the Ir Miklat? Because the Goel Adam still has a claim on them. Because the person who's meaning Rachman Letzlan, we're talking about somebody who is not being careful enough, and a life was lost. The family, the children, the uncles, the aunts, the siblings, everybody over here, there's a terrible state of missing and almost anger that there's something going wrong because somebody was not being careful enough. Because somebody just wasn't driving carefully, wasn't whatever it was. So now what happens is that the Torah recognizes, and Torah says, if those people, not the Torah says condones it or recommends it, but Torah says, if those people choose to take the life of the person who wasn't being careful enough, they have the right to, and they will be acquitted of that murder, of removing that person, unless they have refuge in Eir Miklat. That's what the Eir Miklat is for, is to protect that person from the Goel Adam, the people, the redeemers of the blood in the family. That's the way it works. So you could have a person who maybe goes there first, goes to court and is returned there because that's going to be the refuge until the Kohen Gadol passes away. That's the general way things work. Now, if that's true, let's think about this for a second. So who is right? Who is right in this case? We have over here a person who perpetrated a murder. Let's say it was unintentional, maybe. Let's even say it's unintentional. If it wasn't intentional as well, even worse. We have a Goel Adam. Does the Goel Adam have the right to eradicate this brother? The answer is? Yes. So what's she saying? So what's her grounds? Right? Meaning, is she trying to subvert the law? Is she trying to make an exception? What's going on over here? What's her grounds? Yeah, Alicia. Good, great. So fascinating. So what Alicia is saying is what the Ralbag says. The Ralbag says a very interesting thing. He says that maybe the king has the license to, so to speak, stretch over the law. That works usually in the opposite direction. Meaning, usually the case is like this. Court can't prosecute this person because of some sort of limitation. There's a statute of limitations. There wasn't Hasra. There wasn't Adam. The king says, I saw the smoking gun. I saw the blood on the floor. I saw the fingerprints on the knife. I didn't have their witnesses. Take him to the gallows right away. The king can do that. That's when the king can also subvert the law. Can the king go in the opposite direction, which is our case? Here, you may have legal grounds to kill the person because of the Goel Adam, even though there's no witnesses. In this case, there's no legal in terms of court, but legally, the actual Goel Adam can kill this person. Can the king now be Mekil? Can he draw that back? The Ralbag argues, yes, maybe the king can do that. Other Mepharshim are bothered, and they say, the king doesn't have that right. The king can't acquit people. There's no sort of, waving the magic wand, signing the paper, and everybody's free. Doesn't work like that. Right? So take a quick look at the way that Radak tries to resolve this issue. He's dealing with exactly our problem. Let's see. Oh, here we are. It's in 35. Thank you so much. On page 8, V'im Tomar, and if you're going to ask, Hare Haim Goale Adam V'cham Levavam, they're experiencing this terrible instability, this anger at what happened. Surely, in the end of the day, if they're allowed to, Aval Bikain, Omar Kain, Omar Pen Yerdof Goel Adam Acharei Aretzach Ki Yicham Levavoy. Aval Elu, what's in this particular case, Ein Levavam Cham Al Ze, Aval Kavanasam Laharog Es Hayoresh Kdei Sheyirshu Heim Hanachala. So she's saying, in this case, it's not because they feel upset or angry that there was a hole created in their family completely without care. That's not why they're doing this. Because she tells us why they're doing it. What do they want? The real estate, right? They understand. If the remaining son dies, then what's going to happen with the real estate? This guy's a magnate. He's got property all over the show. Where's it going to go? So it's going to go back up to our family. So that means to say she's actually accusing them of using the Goel Adam vehicle to further their own financial interests.
It's not the only thing she's saying. She's saying that, yes, they would take the Yerusha, and Ashmi Gama Yoresh, which means the Rid of Yerusha.
Right.
The Kibu et Gachalati, which means that she's also claiming that she's going to
That is a byproduct of the situation either way. Meaning, whether or not they're intending for the Yerusha or for the Goel Adam, she's going to be there's going to be the sort of the spark of her husband's name, so to speak, is disappeared. It's going to be the classic case of Chalitza, right? Not Chalitza, where Yibum is not performed over here. In this case, where they're not willing to allow this on, that isn't. But the grounds are what the Radak is saying.
Bigger picture,
you're right. You're right, but in court, what would float? Meaning to say, would that float? That is for the emotional part of it. But and that is obviously going to impact David, it's going to influence his decision. But technically speaking, they're still Goel Adam. So what makes her case float in terms of the legal, she's saying, they're not doing it for the right reason. The Torah says only v'cham levavoy, because they're experiencing such trauma from the death, that's why they're doing it. These guys are smoking their cigars, they're walking in with the mafia, they're interested in just simply taking the title. So that's her claim. And by the way, yes, we need everything. No, it is. Everything is based on there has to be the legal and there has to be the emotional. This is the final words of the lawyer in front of the jury right now.
One word, gamita yoresh, and then she goes in to explain how she's not going.
You're right, but let's say you are in the jury right now, Dina. So that's a bad example because the jury is emotional. They're not legal, right? So yes. So there are two things which make people's decisions shift, and one is intellectual and one is emotional. Intellectually, it's the Yoresh, and emotionally, this other one. Michelle, you had a thought? Okay, so that seems to be level number two. Now, this is a very fascinating thing, because what's happening over here is you already see something happening, and that is that she is asking David HaMelech to kind of, you know, she's giving reasons, but she's asking him to really, like, move around the law, right, a little bit, right? And so, you know, it does sound like she's asking him, the emotions she's asking him to draw out of himself are good emotions. Mercy, right? Compassion, patience. These are good emotions. Not all good emotions are good where they're applied. We have to ask ourselves, you know, when she's doing this, is this a good thing? Is her claim one which is worthy? Not so clear. Let's take it one step further. There seems to be a disagreement between the two of them. Not an overt disagreement, but there seems to be a disagreement from the fact that there is a dialogue. The fact that he says, I'll speak to you, I'll get back to you, and she says, no, you're going to be acquitted, and I'll take the responsibility. And then he makes an oath, and then she says, okay, let me go to the next stage. The fact that there's that du-siach, right, we're having this dialogue, it expresses the fact that he has not given her what she wants at the beginning. What is it she wants, which she's not getting, which she has to push for? The Mephoshim will struggle with this. Take a quick look let's see if... we're not going to look in the Radak itself, but just outside what he says is the following. Is David HaMelech kind of says, I'll make sure that your family won't affect you. Your in-laws are not going to come. I'll put a restraining order on your family, as an example. So her concern is that's not sufficient. Because who's going to say that a package doesn't arrive on the door tomorrow? He opens it up and goodbye. Right? Meaning it doesn't have to be. They've got a restraining order on them. But that doesn't mean to say that he's protected. What David HaMelech needs to give to her is lo yipol misaras rosho, that no hair on his head is going to be touched. I will assure him protection, not that I'm going to restrain those perpetrators, because they have many friends, they have many extended family. So that's what the Radak says, is the dialogue is how much protection is he offering? Is he addressing the immediate threat, or is he addressing the absolute security? That's what the Radak says, seems to suggest the dialogue, which is, by the way, she is clearly a lawyer, right? She's got all the loopholes covered here, right? There's no way to get through. But the Abarbanel pushes it further. Dear, the Abarbanel pushes it further. I think this is really remarkable. Take a quick look at the top of the page here in this Abarbanel himself. He says, "Va'ani achshav shamelech omar lechil veseich va'ani atzave alaych." He says, "Rotze lomar ein roi li lahamin divrei habaldin." Why is he saying go home? Because he says, I've only heard one side of the story. And he's right, by the way. There is never one side of the story. Never, ever. Never since the world was created till now has there ever been one side of the story in any argument. There's always three sides to the story. What A says, what B says, and what the truth is, which is sometimes in the middle. Right? So therefore, what he's saying to her is, I've heard what you said, and it sounds like a terrible, atrocious situation, but I need to hear from them. So you go home, I'll speak to them, we'll work it out, right? We'll deal with it. That's what he's asking. And she says, V'ha'isha, lo nisratzes b'chakirosh. She's not taking that. What's going to happen when he dials the number on the resume? It's a dead line, right? This story doesn't exist. This is all fabricated, right? This is a story. This is not going to work. You can't call Studio 7. It's not working. She says, this is life and death. I'm the last surviving member. You have to believe me based on my word, and you have to act right now. Anything that happens is going to, now I'm going to be the one who stands to lose. She's not taking responsibility. She's saying, I stand to lose all of this. She has to do this. So by the way, this is whenever lies happen, you know, usually it just leads to more lies, right? Because when you deal with truth, wherever you go, you bump into truth because it just is there, right? But when you're lying, or when you're fabricating something, you have to keep fabricating because you always have to keep creating the external paraphernalia and the behind the scenes that keep on going to be able to substantiate the story you've told. So she's stuck in a corner now. She can't allow him to do the natural research, says that Rabbi Nel. So she has to push it. She says, I'm in a desperate situation. I'm the last of kin. I'm feeling threatened. I can't walk out that door, David HaMelech, until you tell me that. And that's what she's essentially doing. And she has to do that. She has her back to the wall. Very, very, very strong. She was coached, but at the same time, you don't get this unless you know yourself. She's an Isha Chachamah, exactly. She knows what she's doing. She knows exactly what she's doing. Therefore, when she says, she demands that Hashem should remember this, this is where the Rabbi Benel points out the parallel we noticed last week already. And this is, I would like to just drop down over here into if you see in the middle of the Rabbi Benel, it's the little Yud Aleph. In the little Yud Aleph, in towards two thirds of the way down, he says, "Va'omnam, mash amrahi od yizkor Adoni Amelech es Hashem." Hashem should remember this. Show what you're doing. Who kemeshiva al mash amar Amelech shabadaber elo tviyayu lufonav va'omra she yizkor es Hashem. So he wants to bring the other person in front of her. She says, "Hashem should remember." Va'zikaron azeh habayinian bnei Adam harishon kesharag kain es hevel. What does it mean Hashem should remember? Hashem should dig to the annals of history where the first murder was perpetrated, where there were two young men who were brothers who were in the field. Yes, it's the same story, says Rabbi Benel, that she's referencing. Shakel yisporach loy harag kain v'yoso hareg. And even though the one brother killed the other brother, Hashem had mercy on the remaining brother and did not kill him as the father, as the, so to speak, the family, who could have been the Goel Adam on behalf of Hevel. Because they're brothers. Ukedei shloi yirbe b'mechilas avia b'mechilas avia mazaken v'kasher kain chashash sheyim suhu habale chayim v'amar v'ayah komotzi argeni. And when he was concerned that anybody or anything will kill him, he nei loy amar yisporach madaber olav v'aviyos v'avosay alai. Hashem didn't say, you know, bring him to me. Let me look into the case. Kasher Amar David, Aval Amar Akosu Vayasim Hashem Ois Lekai Nevilti Akosu Soi Komotzo. Hashem agreed to him, and Hashem said, "I will make a sign to protect you wherever you go." Kasher Amar David, Aval Amar Akosu Vayasim Hashem Ois Lekai Nevilti Akosu Soi Komotzo. So, therefore, what is the woman trying to say? Essentially, is you need to give a sign. You need to show a sign that you're going to offer unequivocal, unconditional protection for the son who is the murderer. Because once she gets that, now she can release the story, right? Because now she's got it from him. That's what she needs. And that's why she's using, manipulating is a very big word. But she is using the story in a way to force David into this corner, and which he does, to grant protection for the murdering son. Now, the thing that the Mephoshim points out, and there's a beautiful sefer on Shmuel called Oz Melech by Rav Yigal Ariel, and he says a very interesting thing, and that is that she's not being 100% honest. Because if she is referencing, which it seems clear from what she's doing, she's referencing the Cain and Hevel story, what is missing from that story? She's not quoting the full story here. Meaning, on the one hand, he got punished, right? So the son who remained, he wasn't killed, but he was punished. More than that, he went to Golos. He was exiled. Where is Avshalom right now? He is in Golos. So do you understand? It's almost the opposite. Meaning, what's Yoav wants to do? Yoav wants David HaMelech to rekindle his flame of love for his son and bring his son back. But Cain remained the ultimate exilee because of his crime. That undermines her case. Moreover, in the end of the day, he did get killed. Shivasayim Yukam Kaim. There was a ultimate revenge, and more than that, he was also disinherited because when he has Shais, the third son, Shas Lelukim Ben Acher, right in place of Hevel, Shais became the progeny or the main line of Adam HaRishon in place of Cain. So, if she wants to really reference this, what she's doing is she's quoting a half-truth, as the Mephoroshim points out, which is not, and this is the danger of the manipulation over here, is this lady actually giving David HaMelech good counsel? Not so clear. Not so clear. When you have rachamim on people who are bad, we don't know if Avshalom is bad yet. But if you have rachamim on people who are bad, you end up like Shaul HaMelech and Agag. That's a much more extreme example. Is being cruel for people who are sensitive with the Nov Ir HaKohanim. This may not be as egregious over here, but we have to think to ourselves: is she doing the right thing? Remember, this goes back to who sent her, as opposed to Nasan and Avi, who comes in front of David HaMelech and talks about the two sheep and the two shepherds and the whole business, and David and Bathsheba and the whole business. And then it's Hashem sending Nasan and Avi. Here, who's sending this lady? Is Yoav. Yoav is a human being. He's not God. So that just also now sort of shadows a well-meaning, well-intended message is perhaps a little bit missing the mark. It might be missing the mark in terms of what it's supposed to be doing. Just to think about this. David HaMelech nonetheless does agree to her. Emotionally, intellectually, he agrees to her. He does promise protection, which allows her now to jump into her next argument. This is where we start. Yes? It's a very good question. Nachon, I don't know if Yoav realizes that Avshalom might be so dangerous right already. He might think that God, that Avshalom is a threat, and for David's protection, he wants David to manage to be protected.
So if he's a threat, then for sure he should kill.
He does. He will. But right now, what it sounds like is he sees David HaMelech in pain. He sees him walking from day to day. He can't experience life in its full colors, in his majesty, because there's so much pain that he's harboring. He wants to resolve that. And the short-term way of resolving it is, David HaMelech, just put it behind you, and we can all move forward, and we'll all be one happy family. And that's what it seems like he's trying to do, but not always does it work like that. We'll see David HaMelech is going to try. It's not going to be so successful. Let's now see what she does. So now she's laid the table. She's got David HaMelech to sign the papers. He's made his shavua. And now she says one more last little thing, David HaMelech. Here's her last little thing. Let's take a quick look at her words. We're now going to quickly move into Psukim Yud Gimel 2. Yud Zayin. Let's see now her response to this. Some complex philosophical ideas she's arguing here. Let's try to understand what she's really getting at. How can you say these things about the nation of Hashem when you yourself are not returning the person who is nidchoy, who is pushed away? Who's that? Avshalom. You're doing the same thing you just talked about. Listen to this. What does she mean here? We will all die, she says. Like water will fall to the ground and never be brought back again. And Hashem won't ever carry a soul. And to think that a soul will never be pushed away from him. What does she mean there? Complicated thoughts. What's she saying? Is this determinism here? Is this an inevitability that she's talking about? Adoni. And now I came to speak to the king. I'm afraid of the people. Maybe you'll listen to me. I'm worried about what the people are saying. Maybe you'll listen to me. Maybe I can help you, O David. Maybe the king will listen to save us. Now she sort of wavers back into her metaphor, right? To save me and my son. Right now she's halfway between message and mashal nimshal. Let your words be like as a resting place, kimalach elokim. Because you are like an angel of Hashem, Kena Adoni HaMelech Lishmoa Tovara Hashem Elokecha Yehi Imach. And Hashem shall be with you. So she's very, very. It's very interesting. She's actually very vague here about what she's doing. It's clear she's dropping references she knows about Avshalom. It's clear that she's making David HaMelech stick with his words. That's what the last two psukim seem to be doing. But what is she trying to really doing over here? What's this? What's this business with the blood, the ground, the water not returning? This, by the way, should also remind us. The first murder which occurred, what happened over there? What was the terminology we saw in Bereshit Perek Daled? Is that when Cain kills Hevel, we talk about Kol Demei Achicha Tzaakim Olai Min Adama. I hear from the ground the bloods of your brothers are calling up to me. And Rashi famously says, all the bloods because of the future, all the stopped generations which aren't there, and the ground is being calling up from the ground. Sounds like the same kind of imagery we're hearing here, right? She's using the same kind of idea of the blood, of the water flowing to the ground and not being able to be pulled back. Sounds like she's using that kind of Hevel imagery here, which is very powerful. But what is she saying as apropos about Avshalom, about the son Avshalom? So there's two subtly different ways of looking at this. One way of looking at it is what the Metzudas David says over here on the page, and he says a very simple, basic argument. She's saying that life is inevitable. So how does that help us? There's an inevitability. All life ends. If so, what? He says, Kimos nomos, chazara in Psalm 39, lavit anot letovat Avshalom. Now she says, I'm going to now defend Avshalom. We're all going to die in the end of the day, right? We're all human. We all are frail. We're all vulnerable. He dies now. He dies then. Why are you so excited about killing him now? Give him a little bit more time. He has an X on his head. Hashem will take care of him at the time that he needs to. You don't get involved. Since he's going to die, you should not be the one to murder. Really, he was not warned. So therefore, it's really God's department. It's God's department that God do his business, and you don't get involved. What she's doing over here by saying this is a very powerful thing, because this is in fact the theology, or the rather, actually perhaps in this case, the philosophy of David HaMelech himself. Because if you remember back to when David HaMelech is running from Shaul HaMelech, in the famous episode in the cave, what happens is that he's in the cave and he sees Shaul, and Shaul is relieving himself. He goes up to him, he's about to kill him, he pulls out the knife, and he cuts the edge of his rope. He can't kill Shaul HaMelech. Shaul leaves the cave, he runs after Shaul, and he holds up the edge of the cape, and he says, is this your cape or not? And then he launches into a very strong tirade, and he says, Shaul HaMelech, because of what you did to me, you deserve death. The way you treated me, the way you treated other people, you are liable for death. Yes, but I'm not going to be the person who's going to kill you. Meaning Hashem, he says, Kasher Yomar HaMashal HaKadmoni, like the Torah says in its original parable, Merashoim Yetze Resha, from evil will be perpetrated by evil doers. I'm not going to be the person. I'm not going to be the vehicle of Hashem's retribution. Hashem will find a way, and Shaul HaMelech will meet his end. And was he right? Yes, Shaul HaMelech died in the hands of the Plishtim. David HaMelech says, I don't need to take that. What she's doing is she's using his own philosophy on him. Avshalom is Hashem's department. Why are you getting involved, David HaMelech? Why are you getting so upset about the whole business? Let Hashem take his course in action, and don't do this. It is interesting to me. It is interesting that later on, when Avshalom is even rebelling against him, and Avshalom needs to be eradicated, David HaMelech is still not willing then to eradicate him. He does not want anybody to kill Avshalom. Whether because he's feeling the fatherly bonds, whether because he swore, or whether because he's hearing this argument over here, which is that don't take justice into your own hands. Let Hashem deal with it. This argument resonated with David so much, and it makes sense because it was David's own language which he's using to him. Wow, very powerful way of it. This is David HaMelech's actual emblem, which is using against him. Rabag says it slightly differently. Listen to the way he says it in Source 40. Kimos namus, he says, kolonu kumoi maim hanigarim arzo, shelo yiskabtsu le'amod me'agara, kein b'nei adam dorchim el amoves. So we're all sort of moving towards death. V'lo yisai lo kim nefesh, la'atzila me'amoves, ratzei lomar, meaning to say, by killing Avshalom, have you brought back Amnon? And the answer is no. Understand your emotion, David HaMelech. Why are you so upset? You're upset because your firstborn, a child you have such a connection to, has gone. By doing this, by letting this fester and brooding on this and waiting for this moment, are you going to improve anything? And the answer is no. So why are you doing it? Right? You're not going to be able to pull that water back out of the ground. You can't extricate. It's not going to come back. What's going to happen? You're going to now just feel worse. And you're going to spend the rest of your life with a cloud of your head and that guilt that you did that to your other son. Right? And we so many times we know this. There's so many times where we take actions where it may be cathartic, but it ain't helping. Right, it's not changing things or bringing anything back. It's relieving the pain, perhaps. It's putting us into a state of numbness where we don't have to address that pain for a little bit. But it's not helping. That's what the Rabbi seems to be saying over here. So again, the different ways of looking at this imagery of the water, right? Of the water falling to the ground, which can't be extracted. The one in the Mitzvot David saying is that the inevitability of life, don't get involved. Let Hashem let life take its course. The Rabbi is saying you can't change it. So why are you doing this? Is that way of looking at Michelle? Yeah.
But then there's no legal system. There's no court system. You know, if somebody murders somebody, well, they're not coming back. So why punish?
You're right. So I think it's all based on the original premise, which is because there were no witnesses, so technically in a court of law this won't stand. So now if it's not going to stand in a court of law, so it's now up to the Goel Adam, which is a great principle, right? So technically speaking, would you have the right to kill him, or would you have the right to eradicate him? Yes, because Chamla Vavoy in the Torah gives space or license for such things. Is that a good idea? She's saying don't. That's what she's saying. We don't know. We don't know. The accusation, you see, if you want to look at a metaphor, the metaphor would place here David HaMelech as the family, right? In a one-to-one parallel, right? David HaMelech is the family who wants to eradicate the son who's remaining. But do we know this? We don't know. Exactly.
He didn't even want to kill him when he was supposed to kill him. But for sure he didn't want to kill him now.
No, that because that could have been as a function of this conversation. But right now we don't know. It seems to Yoav, The way that we looked at it last week was that Yoav sees that although he says to everybody, it's fine, I'm not going out to fight him, there's still the fire is burning, the coals are hot, which means that if Avshalom would be walking across the street and David HaMelech had his spear, Yoav would not be sure that David HaMelech would be able to leave the spear on the wall. That's what he feels, and he wants to attack it now and fix this up. That's his concern. Yeah. Yeah, I know.
We're still missing that
motive. I agree with you. I think this is one of the missing pieces in the story, which is much harder to understand. Cheryl?
You mentioned the fact that there's a justification for Avshalom killing Amnon. I mean,
yeah, no, so that is, yes, you're right. So that was the Malbim. The Malbim said that. Well, the Malbim, remember, the Malbim feels that was the third attack. When he says that, let's go back to the beginning when we focused on that. Yes, he says that they were hitting each other. The two brothers were hitting each other when the one got killed. So he's saying the two were, it wasn't that Avshalom started this business, he was following up on this business. So David HaMelech, you can't get entangled now if you didn't get entangled then. That was exactly, and I was precisely what you're saying, and that's a very strong point. Be it as it may, I just want to just actually close this last section just so we can get a sense of what actually happens, and we'll hold it here for this evening. One thing, we're not going to do it inside now, but if you notice the last two lines, is she's focusing on his adhering to his word. So she's talking about how he's like a malach elokim, like an angel, which means what you said counts. Bein l'rav, bein l'tov, meaning whether it was good or bad. So I got you. I have it. Pictures recorded in my pocket. Right. So she now has him. That's what she seems to be emphasizing at the end of her line. What's David HaMelech's response? I mean, can you imagine if you're the king of Israel, right? You're not just anybody. And now the carpet has literally been pulled out from underneath. You're lying on your back on the ground at this point in time. What are you going to do? What do you say? I can imagine any normal human being extremely angry. We don't see this in David HaMelech. Listen to David HaMelech's reaction. Cool, calm, and collected. How David HaMelech responds. Vayana Melech Vayomer. First words we hear from David now after this. So Apostle Gid Ches, he says, Vayana Melech Vayomer Laisha, I'll not tachachti me many davar. Don't deny anything. Asher anochi shal yotach. I'm asking you one question. Vatomer Yisha, yelaber no, Adonai HaMelech, anything you want. Master my king. Vayomer Melech, hayad yoav itach b'chol zos. Who put you up to this? Is Yoav behind this? Vatane Yishav Vatomer, chay nashacha Adonai HaMelech. I did everything. I didn't even go right or left. It was scripted. Every moment was scripted. I'm not sure that everything was scripted, because it sounds like she really used her own initiative at some points. But nonetheless, she says, it's not for me. I wasn't doing this for myself. I was doing it because of Yoav. Remember, she's also protecting her own interests now. Because Yoav was doing this, and Yoav was your servant. He wasn't doing this on his own initiative either. You understood why this was done. You understand why this is necessary. Please understand why we are doing this in your best interest. Seems to be her point. How does he know, by the way, that it must be Yoav? Because what deal does a woman in Tekoa have to do with his son? How does he know the private news in the family? So it must be, he realizes that Barbara Dell says automatically that she has inside information which nobody else is privy to, which is why he works out who could be, and it must be Yoav. So listen to David Menasseh's reaction. Now he knows that it is Yoav. What does he do? He doesn't even turn to her. So she no longer exists at this point in time because she's been set up by Yoav. So what does he do? He says, he says, Yomer HaMelech El Yoav. He says, no, Yoav, let's speak. I've said this. You got me, right? Can't do anything. I said it. I put down the verdict. Bring back Avshalom. Wow, you're so incredible. You even listen to your servant to acquiesce to this. He goes up north to Geshur, to the area of the Golan Heights. He brings him back down south to Jerusalem. He goes back to his house. He ain't seeing me. He's not looking at me. He goes to his house, the king doesn't see him. So you see over here, you see on the one hand, whenever you create an artificial structure, it always remains artificial. Meaning, what has Yoav done? Yoav has tricked the king into fixing this relationship. And it's not coming from the king. It's not coming from David HaMelech. So what you see over here is that the king is living in this artificial realm. Now, why would it be that he doesn't want to see him? I mean, like, is David HaMelech, is this his way of getting back at Yoav to show he's not going to do this? Is it because he's showing his anger to Yoav? You put me in this situation, but I'm not going to play ball with you properly. You can bring the horse to water, but you can't make a drink. I'm going to show you. Is that what's happening? Barbara Nell says no. David was more noble-minded than that. He wasn't a small person. The reason he did this is because like this. Here you have a person who goes around, uses the king's word to murder people, the king, the crown prince himself, and all of a sudden he walks back in town, and the whole motorcade, and and there's a half day off of work, and there's balloons and candies and everything like that. He says, I can't recognize him. He may be acquitted, but he's not a hero, right? Let's say I agree with my word. So that brings him back to neutral, right? That doesn't make him a hero. I can't give him credence, I can't give him time, I can't give him face time, because otherwise what am I essentially doing is I'm turning a murderer into a hero. I'm prepared to do what I said I would, which is to exonerate him. But to do more than that, I can't do that. I can't bring myself to do that. But, although that might have been nobly minded on David's part, how is Avshalom going to interpret that? He's going to feel that this is David HaMelech continuing to reject him, which perhaps was the reason in the first place that this all started. So far from actually bringing them closer, what does this do? This brings them further apart, which is the tragedy of this thing, which now sets us up for Avshalom setting himself up. Yes, Dina?
But maybe he was doing it for Avshalom and not for David.
Hard argument to make. Yoav is the ultimate loyalist. Nothing gets in the way of David HaMelech to the degree that he's going to be the one who's going to kill Avshalom in the end. No, that was the very end. He let him live.
He
let him live. I can't.